Good morning. I'm Chris Farrell, filling in for Carrie Miller. What I want to explore this hour is the high cost of poverty. Simply put, it's expensive being poor. You pay more for services. The price of milk and bread is higher in corner store markets. You spend more time and stress dealing with everyday chores like washing clothes instead of bank accounts and direct deposit. The poor have check cashing and payday loan providers. Worst of all, the effects of mass incarceration deny millions access to mainstream jobs in society. As the Washington Post put it several years ago, the poorer you are, the more things cost, more in money, time, hassle, exhaustion, menace. So what does this reality tell us about poverty in America today? And we're going to explore this topic with two experts. Tracy Ross is an associate director of the All-In Cities Initiative of PolicyLink. PolicyLink is an organization that works to advance creative solutions that foster equitable growth, community revitalization, and democratic engagement. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elaine Rasmussen is Chief Executive Officer of Social Impact Strategies Group. The firm works to strengthen communities with innovative strategies for equity and social impact. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
Okay, so before I get to the questions, I just want to give out the number. Do you have experience with the high cost of poverty? I mean, tell us your story. We want to hear from you. Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. So to start out, and I'll start out with you, Tracy. Is the premise right that the cost of everyday services and products, you know, from buying milk to having a bank account, I mean, is that higher for the typical person living in a poor neighborhood?
Absolutely. And yeah, I'll start off with just anecdotal evidence, but, you know.
Hello? Hello?
I'm still here.
Okay. Elaine, I'm going to toss the question to you. Same question.
Same question.
Yes.
So I'm going to copy Tracy and just speak from my own personal story. At the age of around 30, I had a three-year-old. I was a single parent. I was in poverty. I was kind of college educated, had trouble finding a job after over 6 months, could not find a job, and had to go on to public assistance. And part of that is once your car breaks down, you can't go pick up your child. And if you can't go pick up your child on time, most child centers charge you $1 a minute for every minute that you're late. So not only are you facing traffic if you do have a car, if you're on public transportation and you can't get to where you have to be, there's a charge for that. Then it just backs, it just, the snowball starts to build from there, right? So your car breaks down, you can't fix your car, you can't pay the child care, your car is parked on the street, you get a ticket, you can't pay the ticket, and it just rolls and snowballs and snowballs and snowballs until it just feels like it's insurmountable.
So I want to go into more depth into this, but taking a step back, I was listening to the radio the other day, and somebody was complaining about how, you know, the low-income Americans get all this free stuff. They get free health insurance. They get free housing. They get free child care. And hardworking people, you know, are really struggling to pay for their child care, their housing, their transportation, which they are. But this notion that there's a lot of free stuff available to low-income Americans.
That is, there's two sides of this myth, right? So while there are services that are at low cost or no cost, the actual amount of work that you have to qualify to get to those benefits is enormous. And then going back to the comment that you made about mass incarceration, so let's say that somebody is convicted for, let's say, a nonviolent crime.
Right.
If a person is in public housing, that partner cannot come back to live in that household. So now you have two parents who are living in separate households, paying separate rent because if one parent is under subsidized housing, that second parent can't live in the house, right? So you've got that issue. But then I think that there's another side of it that nobody really likes to talk about, which is all the free things that corporations get. What's the welfare that we have for the other side of the coin? There's a lot of welfare, which we don't call welfare. There's lots of corporate benefits. We have significant amount of tax reduction that's not paid by corporations. So when we're looking at welfare, there's this disproportionate view as it relates to black and brown people because they're black and brown people. It's an institutional racism when we look at welfare, when it has to deal with the poor, which are disproportionately people of color and Native American, as opposed to the welfare that we offer corporations or people who are of a different affluent status and predominantly are white.
So, Tracy, I believe you're back. We have you back.
Yes.
Yes. So let's go back to the question that you were just starting to answer in terms of what are your thoughts about the high cost of poverty and that this is
sure.
a good and why is this a good place to start a conversation?
Right, because I think that there's a misconception in our country that if you're poor, it's somehow evidence of some sort of moral failing or that you're lazy, when really it's a evidence of a lack of funds. And that's something that I think needs to be very clear, that constantly people are just saying, well, why aren't they getting a job? Why aren't they working? The news at the top of the hour was talking about the candidate you all have for governor, Republican candidate Jeff Johnson,
right.
who's talking about work requirements. And there's never a conversation, though, about, well, what's the work? What are the jobs? And so I think this concept that people are poor because they want to be in that station of life is actually just really offensive because folks are working as hard as they can. They have the cards stacked against them as, you know, cost of living increases while wages have remained steady or even declined. So it's incredibly costly to be poor just in terms of the real dollar amount of earnings that we have today, but also because of if you're a low income person, you're going to be subject to predatory loans. You're going to be subject to so many other additional costs to be able to just access the kinds of services that middle and upper income people can access without these sort of punitive measures.
So, you know, we look at, say, in a metropolitan area, low income metropolitan area, you know, groceries, lack of choice, lack of competition. I mean, is part of the answer here to get more competition moving into lower income neighborhoods, or is that, you know, been tried and isn't working?
I would say that part of the issue is that folks don't take a chance on low-income areas. It's not about competition because, you know, low-income people buy groceries. They need access to food. And so it's really I think there's misconceptions on the part of many business owners, small business owners, that you can't have a business that's thriving. And I think that there are small businesses that are popping up in North Minneapolis that are proving otherwise, that are employing folks in the community. And so really, it's just I think it's negligence on the part of many of the business owners. And I think that there is a role for cities to encourage development in these areas. I'm glad that you brought up metropolitan areas, because where you live does matter. So that's another factor that's incredibly important, that a low-income person, say, in Hennepin County, if they were moved to Carver or Ramsey County as a child, even if their income stays the same, they will have better outcomes over the long term. So you can have people that are still low income, but their environment matters tremendously. And so I think that we need to be very serious about investing in high poverty areas.
Okay, I want to go to the phones, but first let me just give out the number again. I mean, do you have experience with the high cost of poverty? Childcare. Childcare is a big issue a lot of families are facing. Transportation, getting yourself to the doctor or getting yourself to work. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your story. So call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. And let's go to Jeff. And Jeff, you're in Shoreview?
Yes, I am.
So what's your observation?
Well, it's a story, and I'll try and make it as quick and as coherent as I can. About 5 years ago, my wife and I worked with a gal that was a homeless veteran and also paranoid schizophrenic. So, you know, a lot of conditions that played into this. But she took out a payday loan for $400.
Right.
And before too long, not only was the interest rate, you know, absolutely astronomical, probably about 1,300%, if I remember correctly. But in order to get the loan, she had to give them her savings account number and arrange for payments to be done by electronic payment. Once the company had that, they then accessed her savings account, sometimes as much as twice a week, for service charges of $25, and those $25 were never posted against the balance. And in fact, even her payments sometimes were not posted against the balance. And I got involved, found the company was being sued in Nevada by the federal government at the time. I was able to download off the internet then the summons and complaint that the federal government filed. We took that to her place where she had her account, and we were able to use that to get the payments stopped so that they couldn't access the account anymore. And then we forwarded that along with the forms that you do for our state attorney general, and ultimately we were able to stop what was going on. But the key thing here is that the practices of these companies is utterly outrageous. And the other thing is that a lot of our poor people do not have, for example, internet access, know how to search, do all these other doggone things, plus the attorney general's office.
That's right. So let's go, Elaine. So one of the points that he really raises, extremely important, is when you're poor and you're living on the edge, fees can nickel and dime you. They're an annoyance to me. They're a real annoyance. They make me annoyed. But, you know, in the end, I'm going to pay them if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the sense of these fees that are attached to a lot of the financial services that low-income people are using, you know, that is just a real detriment both to building up savings, getting a decent credit rating, all the things that, you know, we're all trying to do as part of this society. Elaine?
Absolutely. And it's not just financial services. It's literally everything. As Tracy pointed out, it's you're paying more for groceries. You're actually paying more. There's also intrinsic costs, right? So if you live in one of these low-income areas, there's a lack of transportation, which means you may have a bus that runs once an hour, which means you may have to get to your job a whole hour earlier than you actually need to be there, and you may have to stay a whole hour later than you have to be here because the bus that runs to your community only runs once an hour or once every 30 minutes, which means you're going to be late to pick up your kids, which means, I mean, so once again, it starts to cycle again all over again of you just not keeping pace. Do you stay home and take care of your kids, or do you go and work? And on top of that, just the fact that a lot of these services, so banking hours, doctor's hours, they're all pretty much 9 to 5. Many doctors don't have Saturday hours. They don't have evening hours.
Right.
So then now we're talking about what's the impact on our healthcare system, because people can't even go to the doctor because doctor's offices aren't available to them because they're actually working and they're still on the edge of poverty. So it's not just people who are not working, right? There's a whole gamut when we talk about people in poverty. And I think the rhetoric sometimes really de facto comes back to just people who aren't working. But in the situation that our caller talked about of here's a homeless veteran, right? This is somebody who served our country. There's no reason in the world why they should be in that situation in the first place. But this is somebody who served our country. This isn't somebody who's sitting at home eating bonbons all day and just collecting free benefits and enjoying the fact that they don't have to work.
Exactly. And this takes place in Massachusetts, but I was doing reporting out there and home care aides, and it's a minimum wage job. And many of them would have two or three clients. But if you looked at daily, they were spending 4 hours a day getting to the various clients and then back home.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that, you know, 4 hours a day, public transportation to do your job, earning a minimum wage job, it's exhausting. I mean, that was one of the things that really exhausted the workers. The work they enjoyed, it was getting to the work.
I will tell you even my own personal story. So when I decided to go back to get my master's degree, I was 33 years old. I was working at a job that was paying me $12 an hour. I happened to be working at a university, which is how I was able to go back to school to get my master's. I was working a full-time job. I worked a part-time job at a retail department store, and then as part of my master's degree, I had to do an internship on top of that. So just in trying to navigate all of that while raising a child, and once again, like, I wasn't making a whole lot of money, but just what was involved in that and having to try to scramble to keep all those balls in the air, make sure my child is fed. It's not as easy as people are looking at it through their own lens of like, oh, I've got somebody who can, or friends and family. I've got friends and family to pick up my kids. When I moved to Minnesota, I knew absolutely no one. When I moved to Vegas, when my child was 5 or 6, I knew absolutely no one. So I didn't even have a support system that I could rely on top of all of the other things the weight I was carrying.
All right, let's go to Simon. And Simon, Grand Rapids?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have a couple of things. I really appreciate the conversation. But my main reason for calling, I just really want to underscore the idea that there aren't, especially when I heard the same comment at the person running for governor, the whole idea that there's all these army of poor people out there who just need a bit more of a kick in the pants to give them some work ethic. In my experience, it just isn't true. You know, out here in rural Minnesota, there's so many low-paying jobs. I mean, you can get, if you're lucky, you can get a $10 an hour job here in Grand Rapids at Walmart, at Cub, at an assisted living facility or something, and people are getting, I know so many people struggling to pay for rent. They really can't pay for rent, never mind get food and everything else on that. And they, you know, they're all wanting more hours. Everyone I know is wanting more hours, or people just wanting, some people, you know, especially if you've got some mental health difficulties or something, struggling to get hired in the first place. But really, those people frustrated that they can't work and wanting to work and wanting more hours when they're often working a bunch already just to pay for themselves and their kids. You know, never, let's not even talk about childcare and, you know, you can get housing, even in a town like this, which isn't wealthy, housing's pretty darned expensive, rental housing. And, you know, you can, again, you can get cheaper housing if you move further out in the county. But then the whole issue of reliable.
Well, then you got the transportation issue and everything.
You know, and
yeah.
It's just a problem. And the idea that people just need a bigger kick in the pants to sort of shake them up, it really is. I just think it's just a long way from the truth of what's really going on. Anyway, I've gone on long enough. Yeah. I'll appreciate whatever.
Well, I'm glad you called. Thank you. And I want to go with Annie in Wisconsin, who I believe has a story that elaborates just on what he was saying. Annie?
Yeah. When I had my first child, I was a single parent, and I was working three or four jobs, depending on the time. And I did have family support, unlike Elaine. So I was living in a house very cheaply because my parents were letting me pay really cheap rent. And one of my bosses offered me $1 an hour raise. And if I took that raise, I would have lost that daycare assistance that I was getting and the state health insurance.
Yeah.
So to take that raise, it wasn't worth it, because then I definitely wouldn't have been able to pay for insurance, and I wasn't getting food share, but, you know, something would have had to gone by the wayside at that point.
So thank you. I'm glad you raised this.
That brings up such a great point that, you know, goes back to the point that I made earlier of like, these services, there's a high cost, there's a high intrinsic cost for accessing these services. And if you make one violation, if you make, to the point that the caller made, if she got a dollar an hour raise, a dollar, like over the course of this, you know, $40 a pay period, she can no longer get access to affordable childcare. when these policies and these benefits are created, they're actually created so that it makes it super difficult for you to not only access them in the first place. You have to submit all this documentation. But then even to maintain it, you're constantly walking this delicate balance of being able to, like, okay, you know, if I go to the higher paying job, even if she got a job that was probably paying $2 or $3 an hour, that still wouldn't compensate her enough to pay for childcare outside of the affordable childcare that was available to her. So we keep people stuck in this purgatory of trying to navigate between these universes. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And when we hear about, like, what Jeff, you know, our potential governor or candidate is saying, it is, to Tracy's point, it's insulting. It's clear that this person is completely detached, not only from reality, but detached from any sort of real life experience of what people on the ground in rural communities and Native communities and low-income and poor communities have to deal with every single day.
So, Tracy, I mean, one of the things that is very true is there's a very high marginal tax rate with a lot of programs that are targeted helping low-income, whether it's for childcare or for housing. You know, if their income does start improving, they hit a very, very high marginal tax rate. So is this something in your All Cities initiative that, you know, you can kind of work with, or are there ways of dealing with this?
Yeah, so I think that the ultimate problem is that if people are starting to move off of these programs because their earnings are increasing, one, we want people's earnings to increase, right?
Right, that's
but,
exactly
you know,
right.
But the thing that, you know, we'll look at in the initiative that I run is, well, if then people are starting to get kicked off of these benefits, there needs to be something in place. You know, that if that business as usual should be that, as the caller was talking about, you know, she shouldn't have to lose the opportunity for childcare. If she's advancing in her career, she's doing well and earning more, that's what we want. But then why don't we also have affordable childcare for people at that income level? So I think that in when we start talking about getting people off of these programs, we need to make sure that our systems are in place so that people can actually get out and succeed, because that's the ultimate goal. And I think most people actually do utilize our safety net as a way to get themselves on their feet. But then they could find themselves going back into poverty because of making these trade-offs between getting to work, picking up their kids, that sort of thing. And I think all of the stories that we've heard so far, from Elaine, I think just makes me want to point out that, you know, we talk about the poverty rate being about 14%. It's been steady, you know, previous year, the past couple of years, it's been about 14% for a long time. But these aren't the same people every year. It's not just a steady 14% of the country. People are cycling in and out of poverty.
That's right.
And 4 out of 5 Americans will experience at least a year of significant economic insecurity. So this isn't an us versus them. Right now, I'm doing well, but there is something that could happen, whether it's an unforeseen health crisis, whether, you know, it's even a natural disaster. All of these sorts of things make us all vulnerable. So we're talking about a system that benefits all of us. This is, you know, in the rhetoric that we have today, it's trying to pit the haves and the have-nots. We're all in this together. You know, that the vast majority of us, 70% of us, will turn to a means-tested program at some point in our lives. So if we're not thinking about how to make the system better, how to make sure that the safety net is protected from, you know, the kinds of cuts that Trump and his folks are proposing, if, you know, we need to protect those, and we need to make it so that if I'm able to get off of these programs, that we have access to affordable housing, affordable child care, transportation systems that are connected to job centers, all of these sorts of things. So we need to think comprehensively. We can't just attack programs without having other solutions in place.
Okay, so lots more questions and lots more stories to be told. But first, want to go to the news with Mr. Phil Bacardi. Phil?
Good morning, Chris. Prosecutors have lined up 35 witnesses and more than 500 pieces of evidence in the federal trial of Donald Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. The trial begins with jury selection today. Manafort is accused of tax evasion and bank fraud. It will center on Manafort's Ukrainian consulting work and only briefly touch on his involvement with the president's campaign. President Trump says he is consulting with the National Rifle Association over whether it makes sense for a Texas company to publish downloadable blueprints for a 3D printed gun. Trump says on Twitter he is looking into 3D plastic guns being sold to the public. The president expressed doubt, saying it doesn't seem to make much sense. Officials from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Border Patrol, and other agencies will go before the Senate Judiciary Committee today to answer questions about the Trump administration's separation of migrant children from their families and its struggle to reunite them. But the hearing may have a wider focus. The committee's bipartisan leaders have asked federal investigators to probe reports of sexual and other abuse for immigrants at government detention facilities dating back several years. Authorities say two wildfires are threatening another 10,000 homes in Northern California. One of the fires has burned more than 800 homes and killed six people. Fire officials say it's become the ninth most destructive wildfire in California history. And actor Alan Alda says he has Parkinson's disease. Appearing on CBS this morning, the former MASH star said he was diagnosed with the neurodegenerative disorder 3.5 years ago. Alda is 82 years old. He says revealing his diagnosis might be helpful to others with Parkinson's and tell them that things can go their way. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:32.
America has always elected its sheriffs. Why is that?
The office of sheriff is a critical part of the Anglo-American heritage of law enforcement.
Who are they? How do they get chosen? And how do we hold sheriffs accountable? That's next time on 1A.
1A, today at 10 on NPR News.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community, which donates millions of dollars each year to provide scholarships, protect the environment, and improve health and safety in Minnesota communities. Learn more at ShakopeeDakota.org.
Programming is supported by Xcel Energy, offering rebates on energy efficiency upgrades that can help businesses use less energy and reduce costs. You can learn more at xcelenergy.com/business.
This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. If you're just joining us, our topic is the high cost of poverty. My guests are Tracy Ross, Associate Director of the All In Cities Initiative, a policy link. Elaine Rasmussen is Chief Executive Officer of Social Impact Strategies Group. Let me just give out the number one more time. Call us, 651-227-6000, toll free 800-242-2828. We want to hear your stories about dealing with poverty, living with poverty, the high cost of poverty. And let's go to Tim from Minneapolis. Tim?
Hi.
What is your observation or question?
Well, I guess I have two stories of families that we've...
yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, that we've invited into our family. So, and I guess I would start with, there's two resources I found helpful in kind of in my own understanding. One is a book called Evicted, which talks about the housing crisis and the struggle when in poverty. The other one is a show on Netflix called Explained, and it talks about the wealth gap.
Okay.
So the two stories that I have, one, we had a family move in recently who lost housing and were struggling and really new to poverty, and seeing them navigate the system, it took, I would say, a month, if not more, to start to figure out who to meet, who to talk to, how to get everything covered for their family, and so that they could start to dig their way out.
Okay.
The other is a girl who was who got schooling, really dug her way out, came from a background of poverty, and when she started working and new to the workforce, and just starting to be able to afford a car and housing on her own, her family started to see her as one of the sole resources for their family of five. And so she really struggled with being, where if you come from a place of wealth, you still have a network. She was the safety net for that family.
For that family.
And really, making very little. So.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you called on this. I'm going to, Tracy, I'm going to ask you about the first part of his observation, his story, which is, you know, we live in the internet age. We live in the information age. And yet over and over again, when I've had conversations with people living in poverty, low income, navigating the system is not like going online and sort of, you know, a couple of clicks.
Right. And, you know, different programs will have different requirements. And then sometimes you have to go to one office, you're sent across town to another office. So I think that there are a lot of cities that are working to try and create sort of one-stop shops to make sure that people can access the sorts of resources that they qualify for under one roof. That might sound I guess to some folks like, well, you know, if you need these resources, just go around. But honestly, you know, navigating them on top of just trying to survive, we make things needlessly complicated.
Yeah.
And I want to respond to one other thing that the caller said.
Sure.
He brought up the book Evicted by Matthew Desmond. And I'm glad he raised that because one thing that we have not gotten into deeply yet is how race plays a role. And in Matthew Desmond's book, he showed that Black women were disproportionately evicted from no fault of their own. It could have been, you know, simple things like landlords were targeting them because they had children. They would find any excuse to just evict
them.
Right,
yeah.
And that's the sort of thing that, you know, you can do everything right and play by the rules and still find yourself having a shock that creates an economic insecurity for you. And I think that that book is critically important, just as I was saying, because it underscores the role that race can play in a lot of these issues.
And Elaine, I want to turn to you his second part. Oh, go ahead. But I do want you also to focus.
Go ahead.
So you, I know you, I want you, as part of your answer, focus on the second part of his story, which is that becoming a resource. But you also had something you wanted to say off of Tracy, which is just,
sure.
Please do.
Yes. So just to expound, to once again, give you a real life experience. So I always like to bring up the fact that because people like to say, oh, you know, it's Tracy alluded to, like that people did this through their some fault of their own. I have a direct experience of being evicted from a place because I was a Black woman with a child, and I happened to have another family member who had been evicted from the same property. And because of that, that relative had moved in with me. And because that relative had moved in with me, the landlord had an issue with that and so evicted me for no good reason and said I didn't pay my rent when I actually had paid my rent. So
right.
These are real stories.
Yeah, these are very real stories.
To anything. And then, so remind me, what was the second part?
So the second part is becoming the resource to the family. I mean, you start making a little bit of money, and then the rest of the family really starts relying on you to provide them, become the part of their safety net, and that can cause its own stress.
Absolutely. So the example I give, I was approached by the University of Minnesota, one of the departments, saying, hey, Elaine, we're really looking to build some diversity in our program. We'd like to have more people of color in our program. How do you, you know, we're kicking around some ideas. One of the ideas we've had is that we offer vouchers. And I said, well, you know, vouchers, you know, in and of itself, like, it could be a good thing. I said, but here's the thing that happens, and particularly Black and brown families, it specifically, when, let's say you give a person a $10,000 or even a full ride scholarship, right, that doesn't deal with the complications of if that family only has one car, right? So
right.
While this person might be getting a full ride scholarship, if they get any sort of scholarship money, there's actually a conversation that happens at home about what's going to happen with that money. Whereas I think in some other families, like white families, it's a presumption that the money is going to go towards their tuition, as opposed to in a family, you know, a person of color family, there's actually a discussion like, hey, we need this car repaired, or we're behind in rent, so we're going to pay rent instead of paying your tuition. So these are the complications of if you're trying to get out of poverty by going to college or a paraprofessional degree, and you're faced with like, okay, I got some money through merit or whatever other competition, but then it's like that resource has to be shared because you're surviving you know, there's no point if you can't eat, then what's the point of going to school? So it's like, we need to buy groceries or we need a roof over our head. And that becomes the priority over paying the tuition for you to go to college.
All right, let's go to Jennifer from Rochester. Jennifer?
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
And what is what's your observation or question?
Well, my comment is more the point of coming from a personal situation. I grew up with my mother in a divorced home and with my siblings, and we were not exposed to very good health care. Most of the time it was county health. And as a result, all three of my siblings and myself have sustained long-term chronic conditions as a result of either misdiagnosis or non-diagnosis of situations since we were children. I suffer from allergies to the sun, which was misdiagnosed as a teen.
I'm glad you raised this. This is really about the long-term effects of lack of health care. Yeah. And so are you getting decent health care now? I mean, are you able to?
I am, but the doctors look at me and they're wondering, well, why didn't I get in health care when I was a child? And I'm like, well, and it's not because my mother didn't work, because she did.
Yeah,
she
exactly.
Often worked 80 hours a week, which is above and beyond what everybody else in the neighborhood worked. But that's what you did to make ends meet.
Right. So, Tracy, health care. This is one of the puzzles that, you know, from youth on, I mean, good health care, you know, makes it easier to go to work. It means that there's less cost. And yet, when you look at children in poverty, access to good health care is a real issue.
Right. And that's why, you know, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was so critical, and why calls for Medicare for all are so important. It's unfortunate that in this country we often have conversations where healthcare is discussed as if it's as a privilege, when really it should be a right. It's something that not only just for the well-being of individuals, but if we're talking from a very practical standpoint, someone who has a good job, a lot of jobs do not have paid leave. So if you need to take care of a sick relative, you know, that's going to impact your livelihood.
Right. But that is one of the big divides in our society, is healthcare a right, or is it a company benefit, basically? Right.
It's right. Right.
And this is a true divide in our society.
Right. And this is something that you're actually paying. Go ahead, Tracy.
Well, I was just going to say that it's necessary for us to just be able to have, if we want to have, you know, talk about American exceptionalism and have a country where we're producing and we're competing globally, if we don't have a workforce that can even deal with the fact that on occasion we get sick, then we're not going to have the level of prosperity that as a nation we are trying to have on the world stage. But Elaine, please continue.
Elaine?
Oh, I was just going to say, this calls into where we have to be more thoughtful and more holistic about any of the solutions that we bring to the table. That when we're talking about affordable housing, it's not just about affordable housing. If we're talking about transportation, it's not just about, like for us, the blue line or the green line running through the city. It's really about what kind of access or lack of access are we creating? What, and as Tracy pointed out earlier, what are the things that need to happen to support that if we are going to be mitigating or impinging on access in any sort of way? So I love the idea of we have, I think there's like a teacher's village, right, that's in Hartford, Connecticut. Of this, there's a affordable living space that's predominantly prioritized for teachers as residents. There's all of the services that they would need. There's a clinic in there. There's a gym that's in there. There's but now we're thinking about our communities, which really goes back to, no matter what traditional community you come from, I don't care if you're Norwegian, if you're Native American, we have these traditional life ways that we need to get back to, of like, we build our community around our community. What are the things that we need? And I love the fact of folks who are thinking about building schools, with health care in the school,
exactly.
At least within walking distance of the school, that we're offering, other kinds of services. Maybe there's smaller sibling child care that's connected to the school so that the parents only have one place to go instead of traveling. I've got to pick up my middle school kid from this school, and then I've got to travel another 45 minutes to go, whether it's driving or on public transportation. I've got to travel another 45 minutes to pick up this kid at another school. And so if we're thinking more holistically about our communities, I think, one, we're actually going to see, if we make that invested, we're actually going to see a lot of these other expenses, whether it's healthcare, whether it's all of these, even our health issues, I think we're going to see, and there's actually, I believe, data that supports this, we're going to see a lot of those costs come off the books. Because we're happy and we're healthy, we're actually less sick, not only mentally, but physically, and our communities are happy, and that's when we thrive.
Yeah, and just off of that, one of the things I always wondered is inner city hospitals, why don't they have grocery stores? And because people are there and it can be in the neighborhood. And the notion of schools and clinics that people can walk to that's been around for a long time. I mean, these are the kinds of things that could make a real difference to people's lives.
I'm glad that we're starting to shift from just talking about, the access to care to talking about a comprehensive approach. Because one of the most startling kind of facts that I share with people is that your zip code has more of a determination on your life expectancy,
That's
your
right.
life outcomes than your genetic code. And so the neighborhood that you live in, everything that the two of you are describing in terms of how all of this fits together, we can't just say we're going to address one thing. I'll look at our healthcare system. We have to look at our housing. So much of our housing still has, lead paint in it. There's so many things that we have to have a comprehensive approach to everything that impacts a family's life.
All right, let's go to Betty in St. Paul. You've been waiting very patiently. Thank you, Betty.
Thank you. My question is simply that I don't understand why these programs have a binary end cap.
You're either on the program or you're off the program, right?
Yeah. And the cap is like the example where the woman might have earned a dollar more and would have been off of two or three programs. What I don't understand is why can't those be sliding scales? Why can't they be phase outs where just like our marginal tax rates, where you earn a little more, but you're only taxed, a very small percentage of that extra earning? It seems like the cutoffs, shouldn't be so flat. They should allow people to take, a wage. And I think the incentives are all wrong.
Well, thank you for raising this, Elaine. This is that high marginal tax rate on a lot of these means-tested policies. And, there's a huge controversy about means testing. There's a huge controversy about whether tax reform should really be focusing less on what's going on with upper-income Americans and much more where tax reform can make a huge difference if you consider means testing as a tax system. That can make a huge difference to lower-income folks. Elaine?
Absolutely. So once again, there's a couple of angles to this, right? So you've got the tax code and who it actually benefits. The fact that when we have these conversations about paying your fair share and in proportion. So I think Warren Buffett talks about this of how, his secretary pays more in taxes than he does. Is that the country we want to live in? Is that what we want to set up? That his secretary, who I'm sure is making a good salary, if it's Warren Buffett's secretary. But imagine if she wasn't making that, but that a CEO of a company or an executive is paying far less taxes than the people who are making they're at the 25th percentile the 75th percentile of the salary that's at the company. And I think it goes back to just what we were talking about, thinking more holistically about who we're benefiting and what we're calling things. Like, let's that's another thing that I do in my work, and we're looking at social impact and the strategies that we need to have more inclusive or regenerative economies. It's like, let's really name things what they are, right? So if we're going to be calling the benefits to the poor welfare, then what are the what are we calling the benefits to the wealthy? And are we going to, and naming that we're not calling them the same thing, even though they are the same thing, but really thinking about holistically about what, you know, the earned income tax credit, you know, sometimes is that really a valuable tax credit? I think it is. It benefited me, but I'm also not in I'm not in the poverty level. So I don't know if that is even something that they even use, because they're taking the maximum deductions anyway. So doesn't even benefit them. We like to lull ourselves into this false sense of comfort when we're talking about some of these things, because we think that we're doing good. And we have to be really mindful and actually bringing people in the room to have these conversations about where are we hitting and where are we missing the mark. And by bringing them in the room, doesn't say anything less about our wanting to do good, but really actually whatever we come out of, whatever policy we come out of or policy or procedure that we come out of, that is actually going to benefit the people that we're intending it to benefit. They need to be in the room as part of those conversations.
Absolutely. Well, as part of this conversation, let's go to Paul in Foley, Minnesota. Is that right, Foley?
Hi, yes. You know, I'm over 60, and this has always been a problem. It's never been addressed. It may have been addressed, but it's never been solved. So I think one has to assume that the politicians sort of want it this way, and they want a group of poverty-stricken people to live in segregated neighborhoods. And I think you have to look at the politicians who have been running these cities. And I think the Republicans have a pretty good point when they say it's Democrats have created the problem and are maintaining these ghettos, basically.
So you're saying this is a deliberate policy in order to stay in power?
I do. I think it's a deliberate policy because I think they could solve it. An indication that it's deliberate is the idea that the technicality that makes it impossible for a family to stay together and collect these benefits. Do you see how that breaks up the family? That's an intentional thing to break up families. It's been going on since the 60s, really, especially with the breaking up the black families.
All right, Tracy, I'm going to go. Tracy, I'm going to turn to you.
If I could just respond. Please, obviously, so I appreciate the callers pointing out that there are a lot of issues at the local level. That's, you know, I work with cities across the country. You know, a lot of the cities are trying to, they have to do more with less. So a lot of that has to do with the money that they're getting from the state level, the money that they're getting from the federal government. So unfortunately, you know, while there are a lot of these big cities that are run by Democrats, we have to also just look at the state level and the federal government and what priorities are occurring at that level. So we know that, you know, the programs that the caller pointed out that are important, these are programs that Trump has, and before him, you know, Paul Ryan in the House, have had on the chopping block for so long. So these programs that are being starved, that people rely on, conservatives have been really attacking the ability of low-income people to thrive in this country. And I think that one thing that we have to really point out, and I know that my call dropped earlier, right, but so it bears repeating if I wasn't able to say this earlier, was that wages are not keeping pace with the cost of living. Wages are not reflecting our increased productivity. So productivity has increased by, you know, 74% over the past few decades, while wages grew by about 12%. So we also have to look at our corporations. We can't just say, well, you know, who's in charge of the cities? People are poor because of a lack of money. It's not, you know, it's not that much more complicated than that. You know, CEO pay has, you know, back in 73, CEOs made about 22 times more than an average worker. Now it's 275 times the average worker. So we really have to look at what are the systems that are in place. And I think it's just too simplistic to try and blame mayors or city councils for this sort of issue.
So, Elaine, I want to one of the things from this conversation, and we know also from the data, but one way of framing this whole conversation and the people have been calling in is to frame it around work and increasing the rewards to work. I mean, just off of what Tracy, what you were just saying. I mean, because the evidence is overwhelming that most people in poverty are working. I believe it's 1 in 10, right? So if we frame this around work and increasing the rewards to work, at least that is one way that, you know, in a bitterly divided country, maybe can continue to have this conversation. Elaine?
Well, I'm going to go back to a comment that Tracy made. I feel like this is really putting the problem on the head of a pin, and that this is a larger comprehensive problem, because what's work if you can't get to it? Or what's work if it prevents you from being able to pick up your kids? What's work if you can't access health care because the hours that you have to work are the same office hours as when you have to go to the doctor? So we need to kind of take a step back and really think about what are the communities we want to create, because when we do that, then we can create the communities that are relevant for where we are. What we need to build in the urban area is not the same as what we need to build in the rural area, which is not the same as what we need to build in native communities. So they all need different things by the nature of where they are, how they live, what happens there, what the community is like there. And I think I believe Tracy also mentioned of we need to have more investment across the board. So it's not just public and private money that needs to be thinking about and looking at these things. But, you know, so I'll give you just a hard data point. We know that divestment happens in a community when there is a 7% turn in the demographics of the community. 7%. And we're seeing that happen here in Minnesota. Of these smaller towns, was just on the news not too long ago about of a community turning 9%, and all the issues and purposeful evictions that are happening, particularly because the community has become that 9% is predominantly Somali, right? So there's some deep-rooted racism that we don't want to call racism, but we just need to see that this is what it is. And if you can't address a problem if you don't know what it is, if you can't call it something else, like we talked, the caller talked about being misdiagnosed, you're being medicated for a problem that you don't really have. Well, we're kind of doing the same thing over here. And what I would like to really see is not only public and private investment, but one of the things that I think we've moved away from, and we're seeing a resurfacing of the gig economy as a result of this, of people, right, of us not taking care of our communities, is entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship used to represent over 50% of our gross domestic product, and we've moved away from that. It now, I think, represents like 30%. Business is actually what's going to help. Ownership is what's going to lead to wealth creation.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave. We've run out of time, but thank you very much. Tracy Ross is an Associate Director of the All In Cities Initiative at Policy Link. Elaine Rasmussen is Chief Executive Officer of Social Impact Strategies Group.